This is Across Divides, a series of stories and experiences from communities across the island of Ireland as they meet shared challenges and consider opportunities for collaboration. Find out more at icommunityhub.org.
I'm Susie Cann, and this episode focuses on the role of women in community and how it has changed across the island's history, and how in particular women have shouldered the burdens in times of crisis that has been highlighted again through the COVID-19 pandemic. And to discuss the ramifications of this, I'm joined on the podcast today by Rachel Powell, women's sector lobbyist with the Women's Resource and Development Agency and chair of the Women's Policy Group for Northern Ireland, who recently published their feminist recovery plan for COVID-19. And held a Women's Parliament, a day-long grassroots takeover of the Northern Ireland Assembly. Rachel is also on the board of directors for the Washington Ireland programme and recently advised the Northern Irish government on an expert panel on the development of a gender equality strategy. Also joined by Anne-Marie Nichuren, a poet from the Donegal Gaeltacht. Her poetry has been shortlisted for the Shine Strong Award for the best first collection in Ireland and many other awards internationally. It's been said of her poems that she often captures a whole world of cultural and historical implications in a single, simple, but metaphorically rich image. I'm also joined by Camilla Manju, who's originally from Mauritius. She has lived in England, Ireland, France, and has worked in Northern Ireland for the last 12 years, having studied social sciences. She also holds an LLM in human rights. Her work has fostered intercultural dialogue in the voluntary sector with grassroots organisations. And she's also a daughter, sister, and mother of three. So, Rachel, I might begin with you. We know that there was an unequal burden on women before and then during the pandemic. But why a feminist COVID recovery plan?
Yeah, so for us in the Women's Policy Group Northern Ireland, very early on in the first couple of weeks of the pandemic, we became really concerned with how women were being disproportionately impacted in the Northern Ireland context. And this was something that we were seeing to be particularly severe as a part of an aftermath of the conflict. Women's issues were just never prioritised here. And we were so far behind other jurisdictions in almost every form of equality legislation when it related to women. So we decided we needed a feminist recovery plan. We were inspired by Hawaii. They developed the first one in the world. And we looked at theirs and applied it to a local context. And we were then, I think, the second place in the world to have a feminist recovery plan. So really for us, we were looking at our government and how we have this history of political instability. This was a time when they were really coming together, and we needed them to address the fact that women were being impacted by far the worst, economically, socially, and in terms of health. And I'll just give two examples from the beginning that really fostered this. So we had women contacting us who were being furloughed during the pandemic. So they were being told, you know, they couldn't work, the business was closing, but they would get 80% of their pay. But women who are traditionally in lower paid roles across Northern Ireland were falling below the pay threshold to qualify for statutory maternity pay. And this was just a basic example of where they hadn't considered women. So women were taking their maternity leave 5-6 months early just so they would get it. And then we had another example of women working on the front lines contacting us that PPE didn't fit them because it was made for the universal build, which was for men. And obviously then, you know, there were a lot of women who were either not fully protected or not able to work at all because of this. So we looked at these two examples and thought, if we look across all aspects of our society, economically, socially, in terms of health, culture, all of it, I guarantee you'll find more examples like this. And we did. So the plan was developed by 32 policy experts across 26 different organisations. Huge collaborative project, to try and ensure that intersectional feminism was at the core of it and that the women impacted by each topic had direct lived experience. So that was really our aim with it, that we would not only mitigate against the impact on women, but that it would also address the pre-existing inequalities that led to such a disproportionate impact in the first place. Yeah. And Camilla was also involved in this too, so I was very delighted to have her and contribute as well.
Yeah, and Camilla, we might go to you. You're, and talking about the collaborative nature and all perspectives, your studies brought you on a journey into intercultural work and the dialogues that you've been convening with grassroots organisations. How do you think those conversations that you're having are contributing to our understanding of power or empowerment for women on the island?
We have seen in Northern Ireland and probably across the island that there's a lack of representation of black and ethnic minorities. But when it comes to women themselves, it's even more so. There's loads of statistics that look at how women have been disproportionately affected by the COVID pandemic. But when it comes to black and ethnic minority women, it's even more so. It's like one in four women would be more affected. And I think what the COVID has done is it has uncovered those inequalities. It's not that those inequalities didn't exist. They've always existed. And now it's like it's with the pandemic, it's uncovered that. And the conversation that we've had with Rachel and with other organisations, I think in fairness, there's a lot of people who probably, because there's so many of these issues happening in Northern Ireland and we're still coming out of all the trauma that has existed here across the island, it's almost like it's a forgotten side of society that people don't realise. When they look at it, it's all it's binary, or there's two colours, whereas it's making people realise that there are people who have chosen to live on this island as a place of sanctuary, and that we're here, no matter what it is, that we are part of this society. And there's loads of examples. There's, for example, an asylum-seeking woman who couldn't go across the island for her child to be able to get, because there's only one cardiac unit across the island, which is based in Dublin. Her child could go and get treatment, but because she's asylum-seeker, because of the common travel area agreement, she couldn't go across. Sometimes people don't realise these things, how these would impact. Or if you're married, there's another woman who's married to someone local from here, but because her husband doesn't have the required visa, she can't go out on a day out across the island. So it's little things like that that impact on all of these things. But these conversations are so important because everyone is talking about building back better. And this is what we should be looking at, building back better, because it wasn't good before.
Yeah. And the work you've then been engaged with the grassroots, what kind of work have you been doing? What is that? How has that been, you know, building that conversation and bringing those perspectives?
I think a lot of this has been around giving women a platform, ensuring that they are not just getting a seat at the table, but a voice, because all of these things is about sharing the narrative, sharing the stories. When and if people hear those stories, it will bring it on their radar. Mm. We've also organised more focus groups so that women can go. We've accompanied Rachel to Parliament, to Stormont. There's more conversations around this happening now. So making women more visible.
Yes. So Anne-Marie, I might go to you next, just as we part of our getting to know each other as this conversation deepens. Your poetry is about story, you know, so those stories and that voice, and it's rooted in the land as well. And I'm wondering, as you went to look at, you know, first in your poetry, you thought you would be looking at the land. I remember you've talked about that in the past, the idea of I'm going to find beauty and I'm going to find nature, but actually you find women's stories across time, across the island, and you explore the changes of our understanding of the feminine. And I'm wondering what you're thinking as you're listening to that idea of the importance of those stories.
Mm. And a word that really resonates with me, mentioned here already, is trauma, something that I'm often thinking about in my own work and in my practice as a poet, writer, educator. So my first book, I, you know, really thought I was going to write about the wild environment and landscape of Northwest Donegal, where I grew up. And I suppose the more attention that I paid to the landscape and to monuments and ruins and to the traces of the past that exist in the landscape, the more I was led into thinking about the obscured or hidden narratives around women's lives over the last 100 years and beyond. And then that led me into thinking about my own family story and the separation of mothers and children in my own kind of immediate environment. So that's kind of been a theme that's come up a lot in both of my books. And I suppose during this time of COVID, I've really had this new time and space to consider, you know, family trauma. And I suppose the violence is done by, you know, church and state to Irish women. And also I've been led into thinking about reconciliation and what needs to happen, I suppose, in our communities to heal traumas. You know, is that possible? If so, who needs to take responsibility? What needs to happen?
Mm. And I think listening to the conversation about all of your conversation about the care of women or what women have to care about, you know, and that story of the land that's being told from, you know, a longer perspective, perhaps, that gives us a perspective on how long this narrative goes, you know, how far back it goes. Mm. Is there something about that as well that you've touched on a lot in your poetry about the longer, like giving the long view to help us in what work we do now in the world?
I suppose on a personal level, one of the things I've been thinking about is that progress is not always linear. You know, that sometimes we need to look backwards to look forwards, and feel free to disagree with me. But, you know, I grew up speaking Irish, the language of my foremothers and ancestors. And at a certain stage of my education, you know, there was a break into the English language. And I let that break happen to a certain degree, but during COVID, I started really to think about loss of language and what that means. And I started to think that, you know, you can't reduce language to mere words, but that language is a perspective and a way of looking at the world. And, you know, really, I think over the last 18 months, it became clear to me that we have had a language for the divine feminine and the celebration of women coming from a place of power. And that has been, in the past, the Irish language. And I'm just talking from a personal perspective here. I realised that in writing about trauma and violence against women and the separation of mothers and children, that something useful that I could do is to turn towards my mother tongue and look to that language which celebrates the Kalia and the Banshee and all these women at different stages of their lives. And when I started to think like that, I think I started to open up a little creative space in my practice where people can come in now to workshops or learning spaces and they can start to reconnect with the Irish language. And it's really interesting for me, people coming from coming to workshops with other cultural influences as well, coming in and bringing different, you know, we talk about how language is not just about words, but it's about, you know, it's about community, it's about the way that we treat each other, how women are held in regard, how men are, you know. So it's been a massive kind of shift, I think, in my own thinking and what needs to happen in my life in order to embrace reconciliation.
I speak 5 languages. Wow. Right? And Creole is one of our native language back in Mauritius. And there are certain things that you cannot translate or transcribe, yes, into English. It doesn't convey the same emotions, the same feelings. So I try to make sure that my kids also get that because they're born and raised here. But I still want them to have that connection. Mm. And sometimes through language, it's so powerful. Even the French language, I speak French as well. French poetry I'm sure the Irish language is the same. There's some certain things will not convey the emotions that you have, and the same trauma, the same feelings, the same sadness, or whatever it is, it doesn't convey the same thing if you translating it into a different language
yes,
at times.
Definitely, yeah.
I think one of the interesting things here, I don't know if it's just because I'm from Northern Ireland, but obviously when I think of language, it's become so divisive, like everything.
Yes.
Like every single thing that really exists about this place. My mum speaks Irish, but I grew up just a few miles north of the border, so I don't. And looking at how it's so different from other perspectives. Mm-hmm. But one thing I found around just what comes into my head thinking about women is that one thing that we've tried to do within this sector is we don't care about those other divides. We are not taking part in it. We're going to look at what's good for us and a shared goal. Rather than the rest, but I very much wish that I was able to appreciate the other aspects of language that you two have.
So there's something you're actually, I think we're talking about is some things that have been destroyed, and part of that then talks about the, you know, the care of women has been destroyed, the care of community and the care of the land. And I'm wondering, Rachel, do you think that the root causes of the issues that the Feminist Recovery Plan is trying to address are actually all connected? And when you mentioned intersectional approach, you know, I'm wondering what the themes that, you know, do you think have that?
Yeah.
What does that intersectional approach mean? What is an intersectional feminist approach to? Is it about that, what's being destroyed and what needs recovered?
Absolutely. I think one of the clearest examples in the Feminist Recovery Plan is our pillar. It's at the end of the economic justice pillar, where we talk about climate justice as a feminist issue and how the exploitation of women and nature and how they're all rooted in capitalism and men's exploitation of both. But then when you look as well at natural resources and you look at different aspects of the world, it's women in the global south that are going to be disproportionately impacted. And we took this approach with every pillar that we were looking at. So, you know, we would look at an issue at hand. So who are the women that are being most severely impacted and why? And when we started looking at, okay, we need to be as intersectional as possible on this, I really worked to try and broaden the membership then of the Women's Policy Group to make sure that it wasn't just all white women from Northern Ireland. And it has changed a lot over the last 2 years. But one of the things that we would say then is, right, who's in the room and who isn't? What are we forgetting about? What's missing? And even one of the things from working with Camilla that I hadn't thought about previously was honour-based abuse. And we added this whole aspect in based on her expertise, but then also in a Northern Ireland context, we are thinking that this is something that just happens elsewhere. It doesn't, it happens here too. And other examples would be around, you know, we would look at things like the gender pay gap. Obviously, it's much more severe for women of colour and for disabled women. Then we would look at things such as care and responsibilities, and the impact that has on you, and how it's so much worse if you're in a rural area. So this is the sort of logic that we would apply to most of our things. If there's a form of discrimination happening, what intersecting levels of discrimination are happening here? Because it's not your identity that's making you be discriminated against, it's this systemic nature against that that has been upheld and built and supported by the patriarchy. So really every chapter where you look at it, we reference, you know, women from all backgrounds that we can think of that exist in Northern Ireland. And it's not saying that it's perfect and we've covered everything. We absolutely haven't. But we are just continually trying to learn and make it stronger. So our first plan that we launched in July 2020 was about 137 pages long. You know, it was significant. We found that our politicians weren't really listening. Compared to Hawaii, where all of their recommendations were implemented, ours were largely ignored. So we went out and interviewed 150 plus women, got their actual stories and their testimony, and said to our executive and our government and decision makers, you're ignoring the stats, which are clear as day, that these different groups of women are being impacted so severely. Will you ignore these women's stories? And actually, we were so much more successful the second time round in getting that implemented, getting different recommendations on board. And that led to the Women's Parliament that we had just on Friday with all grassroots women. And we had women from a whole range of different backgrounds speaking about their lived experiences that inspired the plan. So that's really, I think, in my work anyway, I just, everything that I do tries to be guided by lived experience of different women, not just my experience. What am I missing and who isn't here? Which is why I've really enjoyed working with Camilla much more over the last year, yeah. and all the different connections we've mm-hmm. been able to make with other people as a result. So it's been sort of a long-winded yeah, answer for
but
you
it's
there.
Kind of no, but it's kind of elevating those lived experience, and I think that's mm-hmm. what you know, Anne-Marie and Camilla have in yeah. common is about.
I think there was a bit of frustration for me at the start whenever, like, 13 years of being here, it's almost like I went underground almost, you know, like everybody else was talking. It wasn't really, it's almost like what people have, like if you're not, oh, I'm not interested in political things, so I'm not going to be voting. But by not doing that, you're not actually, it's, you're not changing anything. It's actually worse that you're not involved in these things. And I think the, for me, becoming more involved in the sector. In the last 2 years, especially after since COVID, I'm a healthcare worker, so I'm a single parent. I have a disability. So I have a lot of intersection. When you look at the protected categories of people, I fill in a lot of these blanks. And I considered that I'm able to have a voice and I can speak up. And even then, I've been discriminated against, harassed, and having... racist incident, there's been loads of that, but I'm still able to speak about it. But there's a lot of my sisters, that's why I call them now, because we need to be able to connect people wherever they're from, are not able to do that. So I needed to be more proactive. I needed to ensure that I was finding a way, bringing my folding chair to the table, but also making room for others to come. And I remember attending one of these events and thinking, and I actually said that, look around the room. Look how many of, if I cannot see someone who looks like me, whether it's in the political spheres, whether it's in statutory bodies or the feminist recovery plan, it was a lot of frustration. Mm-hmm. I used to go in and be like, this room is really not representative of the society that we live in, wherever it is. So what are you doing about it? You shouldn't be in a room that's not representative of society. And the good thing that I found that with Rachel and with WRDA was that they were not assuming that they were doing the right thing at all times. They were open and willing to learn. And it's like, okay, we hadn't considered that, and we're gonna hold our hands up and say that we haven't considered that. So they were trying to be more inclusive of different things and listening to the stories that, sometimes you can be, not bogged down maybe, but you have your own things that you've been involved with, your own experiences, and it's not difficult, but because it's so much, it's so intense what you're going through yourself, sometimes it's difficult to see things from different perspective. So being involved with that has actually been really good, because Rachel has the connection as well. She's been able to ensure that we had the platform to actually have that voice rather than just being lone wolf on our own. And her being able to hear what these experiences are like for us, she can be that voice for us even when we're not there. That's what I want it to be, because I'm not going to be able to be in all of these spaces at all time. So I need to know that all of the women going up are actually thinking about it and throwing the rope down and ensuring that they are thinking about their sisters, wherever they are, whether disabled women, whether they are women from ethnic minorities. Mm-hmm. And this year's theme is actually, I was looking at it quite cynically whenever it started, break the bias. I was like, okay, break the bias. Is that something, an idealistic view of society that we have? Because we know that it's always going to be there. There's stereotypes that people have about women, where they believe women's place should be. And are we going to be looking at next year and inviting the? And I was thinking, am I going to be the token brown going on these token brown person going on these panels and conferences, or are we going to look back in a year and be like, okay, it wasn't just an isolated thing. We're actually going to work towards something and look at everything that we've celebrated in the past year, next year. It needs to be consistent. It needs to be substantial. It shouldn't be something, okay, we need a perspective of someone from an ethnic minority, so we're just going to do that. But you need to be able to show. And sometimes that's why I always ask, if someone asks me to come and speak about anything, what have you done so far? Who else have you spoken to? And what have you done from what they've told you? Because if you look at it, all of the things, even in the recovery plan, it's things that we've always known about. Mm-hmm. There's no point reinventing the wheel or looking at doing more research and more that. If you go back and look at all the recommendations, whether it's in England, whether it's in across the island, these recommendations have been said before. We know what the issues are. It's the willingness of people to actually do something about it.
And one thing I found actually just after I'd started working a bit more with Camilla, I was feeling really frustrated because I'm the only women's sector lobbyist in Northern Ireland, and I was finding it really difficult to get in any rooms in relation to COVID recovery. And anytime I tried to get in a room, they were like, "We already have one woman here, so we don't need any more women," you know, as if we don't have any opinions on anything aside from women's issues, which was incredibly frustrating. So it was one of the things I was thinking of as well, you know, for broadening the membership of our, you know, women's policy group. We need to have women from ethnic minority communities because they have perspectives on everything, not just issues around race. And the amount that I've learned in relation to healthcare and violence against women in particular, you know, it's just been so beneficial. I think, you know, both ways, you know, we've learned so much more, but also hopefully I've been able to give other women a platform, and it's I just think we all should be doing it.
But it does sound like that it's perspective that really helps. So if the perspectives of the past, of the, you know, when you described that story earlier about the woman not able to, the lived experience of a woman not able to be with her child in a hospital, you know, and I was thinking about some of Anne-Marie's poetry that talks about those separations as well. But that, so as you say, it's not something we've not known. It's an old feminist adage, the personal is the political. So going deeply into the personal narrative.
Can't really separate that. You know, the personal, because I always say, like, working in as a professional now in healthcare, and all, I can't really separate that from that. I will see things in it through a different lens when it comes to ethnic minority experiences. For example, there was a woman who was in hospital and they had made a referral to psychology because they thought that there was mental health issues. But it was only because she wasn't eating and she wasn't talking to anybody. Nobody considered the fact that the food wasn't culturally and religiously appropriate, or that there was a language barrier, or that she was scared and frightened and anxious. They were making a referral. They had already deemed that she had mental health issues. It's things like that. And I think sometimes as women, we can do ourselves huge disservice by not working together. Everybody, I get the feeling sometimes everyone is standing on each other's shoulders, we're trampling on each other to see who get to the top. It doesn't bother me that it's Rachel who goes and speak about but that she's remembering that there are her sisters behind and she's going to try and bring them with. I think that's how we do ourselves a huge disservice by not working together. And as you say, it's the collaboration that we need. And there was this speech they were talking about, right? In every movie, you will always find a woman who would be saying, "Oh, what do we do now?" But women know exactly what to do in crisis. Mm. You will teach kids, you tell people, if you're in crisis, go to a woman, they'll know what to do. So why is it that when it comes to other issues in society that we're not turning to women? We do not need men to be in those spaces to talk about things that's personal to us that we know about. And as Rachel said, it's not only about religious and race matters that I can speak. I'm someone with regards, for example, during the COVID pandemic, I was working as a single parent whenever their school, everything was online working, and the kids were studying at home. Even trying to find childcare during that time for me to be able to go into work was a problem. Then when work did provide childcare, at one point we had to pay extra for it. It was very hard because childminders reduced their numbers as well. And women, most of the childminders were women, they had to reduce their... There's so many of these things that weren't considered. Mm-hmm. For example, people wearing masks. As someone with a disability, hearing impairment, I lip read. Nobody considered the fact that I'll not be able to lip read people, or that, because there's already an assumption that I don't speak English when people look at me, because I've been asked that, "Do you speak English?" So now with the mask, I always say to my son, so now it's not only that people are going to think I'm stupid and I don't speak English. At one point, I just resolved to the fact that I'm just going to leave it, because even going to supermarkets in work and everywhere, everyone wearing masks was an issue. But they didn't also consider the fact I was the only ethnic minority in work. They didn't consider that I would need a different type of risk assessment because ethnic minority people were more disproportionately affected. So I had to go look up a risk assessment that they were doing across the waters because it was specific for these people. Mm. None of these things were really considered.
Mm. Yeah, and I think in relation to COVID, that was one of the main frustrations I had at the beginning was a lot of these issues, if you had have asked someone from one of the backgrounds that we've been talking about, they would have had a solution so much easier than having to change a policy after it's already in place. And I really struggled immensely in the first lockdown. So I have been disabled since I was 11. I have an autoimmune disease and a degenerative bone condition. I had a shield for 9 months. It was incredibly isolating. But my two parents were also disabled and I was their carer, but they live 70 miles away. And there was such a dilemma with that all of the time. And then I had such an immense amount of stress about the work that was going on and a lot of the things that we were raising. It's so frustrating when you have, you know, I have a summary of the Feminist Recovery Plan here, but when you have so much evidence of how women are being discriminated against and you present that to politicians and they choose not to act on it, it is extremely disheartening, particularly because you know women are dying as a result. Mm. It's not just, you know, that they're going to be impacted or, you know, worse off financially, they're actually dying. Mm-hmm. And, you know, throughout the pandemic, Northern Ireland got the title of the most dangerous place in Europe to be a woman. But we still are the only part of the UK or Ireland without a violence against women and girls strategy. We're still the only part of the UK or Ireland without a childcare strategy or government-funded childcare provision. The only part without gender pay gap legislation, perinatal mental health services. You know, the list goes on and on with how much further behind we are. So I really think that those lived experiences are something that is really being led now. You know, people are taking us more seriously with lived experience, even though we have all of the evidence and data to back ourselves up. And something I've noticed now is this is happening on an all-island level. There's a lot more being said now for women across the island because a lot of the issues are shared struggles and there's a lot more power in us all working together on an all-island basis. You know, I think that I have a lot in common with my sisters in England, Scotland and Wales and in the Republic of Ireland. I think in Northern Ireland we have our own issues that we have in common with each other too. But as a whole, we have more in common on an all-island basis and more to gain from working together on an all-island basis, even just purely logistically, you know, just being able to drive down the road and engage with other women. So,
do you think that there are lessons from, you know, from the experience of trying to, whether it's through, you know, community and voluntary sector organisations on the coalface of all of the issues that women face, you know, in all of the different groups and traditions. And I'm asking where the nuggets are for solutions.
I love that John Didion quote, you know, she said, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. And, you know, for me, I'm obviously coming from this, not as a community worker, but as an artist. And that space, I think, for storytelling and narrative and reflecting on the stories that get told and the stories that don't is so important. And, you know, when I think of my immediate surroundings, when I was growing up in Northwest Donegal, you know, despite the fact that, you know, Ireland has a mythology very rich in the divine feminine and the witches and the Kalia, all of that Northwest landscape was really overwritten by patriarchal narrative, you know, saints and giants and stories of, you know, Valor of the Evil Eye and Lu, the god of light, and their battle. And, you know, over the last couple of years, I, like a lot of other poets and writers, have been thinking about, well, where's the female perspective? You know, it goes back to what you were saying, you know, when you don't see yourself reflected in the narrative, even if it is the mythological narrative or, you know, poetry telling kind of, you know, the histories of the island, then it's very hard for you to access your voice, use your voice, know the power of your voice. And I think a lot has changed definitely in terms of the stories that get told in recent years. I'm thinking particularly of, you know, the Waking the Feminists initiative, where theatre makers and performers came forward and protested, I suppose, against the lack of stories being shared by women on the Abbey stage, but that sparked a much wider debate about, you know, the stories that get told in poetry and on film. And I just think, you know, I feel very passionately that there's still a lot of work as well to be done in that regard. And not to take it off too much into the arts direction, but, you know, if I get a book reviewed or work reviewed in the national media, there'll always be a male reviewer ready to talk about how angry I am. But if I get reviewed by a woman, you know, they'll talk about how important it is to be angry and how important it is to express that outrage. And we see that repeatedly in how a woman's work gets reviewed in the arts. And I just think it's so important that you mentioned there, you know, superpowers and how can we access our powers as women. I mean, from a personal perspective, having the freedom to express the full range of my emotions is, you know, central to me being able to be effective in my work as a writer and, you know, to lead a happy life. And for so long that has not been allowed. And in some ways it's still not allowed, you know, to be angry, to be outraged, to, you know, to want to rebel, I suppose, against those norms that are being imposed upon us by patriarchy, by...
Yeah, and I think it's quite interesting because women are always painted as being angry, and I'm like, that's just passion. That's the passion coming out. Mm. But it's not to undervalue arts at all. I think a lot of people got through the pandemic because of art, mm-hmm. the music, the poem, the films, all of that. Mm. And I know Nandi Jula, who's a poet, and she talked. She's a poet in Northern Ireland. She's from. She's a black woman from South Africa, and she talked about how difficult it was during the pandemic to even to get through all of that. But it actually was a lot of inspiration with so much happening, mm. and going back on the stories during COVID. I got COVID in the first year of it, so it was December, it was around Christmas time, mm. so everything was closed off, everybody was shielding, everybody was out. I remember thinking at the time that if I died, and I was self-isolating in my own room, and I'm a single parent with three kids, and I remember thinking, if I died in that room and my kids woke up to that, what would happen? I had no plan in place if something went wrong. I called the ambulance services over to try and get an ambulance because I couldn't breathe. And they were like, there's about 6 to 8 hours of that. And when I think about that, I was like, there's a lot of these things that haven't been considered. But moving on from from the COVID story and what we're going to do,
yes.
and not a lot of emphasis has been placed on mental health services. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How are we mm-hmm. actually going to resolve a lot of these things? Because now it's like we're painting everyone with the fact that everyone's going to have mental health issues now. But is that a normal reaction yeah. to what's happening in the world? Or is mm. that actually mental health issues? Mm. Is that mm-hmm. something that we're mm. going to resolve with just medication or
yeah.
Therapy or anything like that? Or are we going to look at reuniting people again, you know, the social prescribing, mm-hmm. getting people together mm-hmm. again to actually build back better, because mm-hmm. everyone says we are all in the same storm.
But not in the same boat.
That's yeah. it. We're not in the yeah. same boat. Yes. Everybody's going to be dealing with it yes. differently. So recovering from COVID is going to have to be something we're never going to be the same again. Uh-huh. I think yeah. I don't think people yeah. would be the same.
I would agree, yeah. And so when we were doing our relaunch, the second launch of the Feminist Recovery Plan, we surveyed women as well. We did a quantitative survey. 82% of women said their mental health declined during the pandemic. But when we started exploring why, out of those that were carers, 81% saw an increase in their caring responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And their response was they were so incredibly stressed and burnt out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then it was around 65% suffered financially. Mm-hmm. And we started exploring then other themes of, you know, like paramilitary loan sharks, really high risk lending and debt mm-hmm. in certain sectors across Northern Ireland. Also, we asked 50% of ethnic minority women said they couldn't access healthcare mm-hmm. throughout the pandemic and were getting sicker. Mm-hmm. Rural women, 66% said they couldn't access stable internet. And they were trying to do homeschooling and working from home and just feeling so isolated mm-hmm. From the rest of the world. So we asked so many different questions about how were you impacted
and use that then to make a full basis of here's an exact roadmap on how to make things better, not just for women, for everyone. And that's why it's called a feminist recovery plan and not a women's recovery plan, because every recommendation we had in place would benefit men as well.
Yes.
So things like more flexible work arrangements for everyone, greater shared parental leave, you know, rapid investment into mental health services for men and women, you know, a whole range of different things that would benefit everyone, really. And we do get, you know, criticised a lot, you know, what about a men's recovery? And we're like, if you read this, you will see that we are advocating things that will support men too. Even on Friday, I posted about the Women's Parliament. Someone said to me, when's the men's parliament starting? So I replied, saying it started in 1921. And that did not go down well. But, you know, it's being challenged on things, even though we're trying to improve the situation, not just for people like us, but for everyone, for a more fair and equal society post-COVID.
And do you want to tell us a wee bit more about the other areas of the plan that are the plan?
Well, so we have six main pillars across the plan. So there's economic justice, health, social justice, culture, Brexit and a Bill of Rights, and then a final pillar which looks at international best practice, what's being done better elsewhere that we could do here. The biggest pillar by far is economic justice. And a lot of that, we talked about how we need to totally realign our economy post-COVID. We kept talking about this new normal and, you know, appreciation for carers and, you know, clap for NHS workers and health and social care workforce and all the rest. Well, the vast majority of those people are women, and they're in extremely low paid, precarious work contracts, and we can't just go back to treating them that way. And we very much looked at one of the main aspects is that we need to put care at the core of our economy. We need to stop pretending that this is something that people do for the goodness of their heart. It's something women are expected to do because it's considered women's work. And in connecting that to the future, we looked very much at things like, you know, the climate crisis and solutions to that. And if we invest in the care sector as a green sector, and if we gender budget all of our climate change budgeting, that will create a more fair society for everyone. So it was looking at the current crisis, looking at an ongoing crisis, and how we can merge the two. And just to really summarise some of the things that were in it then, so it's huge. It's so big, but economic justice looked a lot at poverty and austerity, gender segregated labour markets and the reason for this. How, when a sector has majority women working in it, they have worse working rights. You know, that's not a coincidence. Things like, you know, government policies on people from low socioeconomic backgrounds and how they're being punished. Things like childcare, and how the fact that we haven't even dealt with the past here has led to issues with paramilitary control and gatekeeping for people in the most marginalised areas. We then also looked at the health pillar, where we talked a lot around the social determinants of health, around racial justice, around bodily autonomy and perinatal mental health, disabled women. In our social justice pillar, again, we talked about racial justice and a lot of the things Camilla mentioned around how disproportionately black and minority ethnic people were being impacted, but other things like women in prison or digital divide and access poverty, asylum detention, detention of trafficking victims and more. In our cultural pillar, it was very much around the way women are viewed in society, violence against women and girls, and misogyny and hate crime. And it's where we did expand things this year as well to include honour-based abuse based on your research. Finally, then Brexit and a Bill of Rights, and then the international best practice. But what made this different was, yes, there's so many stats. Everything's backed by evidence. But we also asked women their direct experiences and their opinions. And that was put at the beginning of every pillar with case studies and, you know, their own testimonies.
And does it have recommendations?
Oh, it has. Yeah. We tried to do a summary of just the recommendations and it was like 78 pages long. So every single, so there's the six pillars and each pillar has its own subsections. Every subsection has a long list of recommendations on what can be done. And the recommendations are, a lot of them are around engagement with grassroots women, but others are looking at what they're actually legally obliged to do, you know, based on different international treaties they've signed up to. Because unfortunately, you know, the UK government is the duty bearer for human rights in Northern Ireland, but we have a devolved government and the Irish government also has a say. Not many are taking accountability for actually enforcing those rights.
So those were some of the challenges. And it was just so comprehensive because, as much as I hate to say it, we're just so far behind here. And one of the things that I mentioned in the Women's Parliament on Friday was Northern Ireland is not a backwards place. The reason we're so far behind on these issues is because they were never prioritised. And that suits certain groups. But our society is as progressive as anywhere else. And we are so political because we have to be to try and get rights for the groups that have been left behind. So that's why it's so detailed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that needs changed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think sorry, the problem go ahead. Here because it's everything tries to be political. Every time you try and bring issues in society, it always turns back to politics. And I always say that it's almost like politicians are all looking to sling mud on each other. So they are not actually, people like us are concerned about the issues in society. Mm. That's what we're more concerned with. None of these, all of these things that happen outside, all of that is superficial. We want to know, I want to know what's going to happen to my kids whenever they grow up. Are they going to be safe? What mental health services for whenever they grow older? We don't want to have to repeat these discussions again. I don't want my daughter, my son to have this discussion in 10 years. We need to be working towards that. And I used to think, I always used to say, when people ask me where I live, I was like, oh yeah, I live here. And they'll be like, oh, is that the under the rock? I was like, it's literally, we live under the rock. Sometimes it feels like that. But it's not for lack of not knowing what to do. Uh-huh. It's the fact that they are not, they don't prioritize it. Mm-hmm. And it's not on their agenda. It's not the highest on their agenda. But we have seen when politicians are really, they really do want change to come. They lobby for it. They campaign for it. You can hear them shout louder for certain things that matters to them. So if these matters to them, they would be shouting louder for it as well. It's about getting them, they always say, if you want something done, if a woman wants you need to get men to actually say it for you, and then it'll be done. Sometimes you wonder.
Listen to them.
So we're coming to the end of our conversation. It's been incredibly rich to listen to what you've all brought to it and the different perspectives that we spoke about, how important those different perspectives have been. And I know that there is the Council of Elders that former President of the Republic of Ireland, Mary Robinson, brought a UN declaration to recognise the unique role that women have in community and peace building, and that almost as a measure of your commitment to community and peace building, it would be very easy to see how many women are included in the conversation about that. So I think that's really what was coming up for me at the end. But I want to go back again to the past a little bit as we finish with Anne-Marie, and we're going to ask you to just that same idea that exactly what you were just saying, Camilla, that the we know, we already know, and we've known for a long time about these conversations and how we are, what you're doing to put that, you know, on every in the forefront of all of that we've been talking about. So Anne-Marie, I was going to ask you if you would tell us a little bit about the background too, but then to read your poem, A Villager Speaks to Ethna.
Be delighted to.
Ethna. Thank you.
I suppose I was really struck by a point Camilla made about, you know, trauma and what's a healthy reaction and what's a mental health issue. And, you know, the right that we have to be outraged. And in my own work and writing, I suppose I've found it so constructive to be angry. And that's been very illuminating to express anger and to find pathways, I suppose, into reconciliation in my own kind of life and work. I suppose one of the things I write a lot about the separation of women and children through the mother and baby homes, because my own family's affected by that. And so I'm often writing about industrial schools, orphanages, institutions, and how they come between mothers and children, or have historically in Ireland, across the island. And I suppose, you know, in recent years, I've been trying to think back to a place before the institution, you know, and what that landscape looked like, which is what led me into, I suppose, the language of my foremothers, and thinking, my gosh, I'm speaking in a tongue that is different to my great-grandmother, and there's a rift there and a break. So I've been thinking myself kind of backwards in time, and I arrived back to the Brehon laws in Ireland, you know, and I was really struck by the Brehon laws that, you know, one of the ways of resolving, I suppose, or addressing a trauma was to bring the community together in a restorative justice circle. And a restorative justice circle would ask, you know, who has been wronged, what is the wrong done, and who needs to repair the wrong. And I started to kind of apply that to my own family story and, you know, started to look at some of those questions. And I started to put some characters in my own book into a restorative justice circle to talk to each other. So growing up in Northwest Donegal, you know, I always heard this mythological story, which is so important in Ireland. It's the story of Balor of the Evil Eye, who he's king of the Fomorian race on Tory Island and a giant. And so the story goes that Balor locked his daughter Ethna into a tower. He stole three of her infants, and he tried to kill them, and one infant survives, and that is Lu, the god of light, Lu and Blavad. The legend says that Lu comes back from his exile as an adult, and in a kind of David and Goliath scene, he wants to take revenge on Balor in a place called the Poison Glen. And Lu tries to put a spear or a stone through Balor's eye, and the poison spills out of Balor's evil eye all through the glen and poisons the place. And that's a story, a really important narrative that I grew up in, with. So I was interested in this book that I've been working on to go back to the daughter who was locked in the tower, and to go back to the stories of women. Ethna, the daughter, Ethna's mother, and Ethna's handmaids. And it's been really kind of cathartic to write them back into this restorative justice circle, you know, where they voice their experiences about what happened in this mythological family. So I'll read one poem from that sequence. It's titled A Villager Speaks of Ethna. And I suppose I was thinking about bearing witness in communities or in society, and telling after the fact. Like, we're all grappling with these questions, I suppose, in terms of women in Ireland and our complicity and, is that the right word? Sorry, you might have to edit that out. We're all grappling, a lot of us in Ireland are grappling with what did we know, you know, when wrongs were being done to women? What do we know now? And, you know, what do we need to step up and say? A villager speaks of Ethna. How many men did it take to drag the girl up into the island tower? Did she spit or kick? Did she try to bite through woolen binds, lifting clumps of skin hair blood beneath a fingernail? Did she struggle? Or was she simply led like a calf by hazel switch into a den? An island daughter bears the rage of pirates in her bones. An island daughter can empty tombs with a curse. Here in the aftermoon of all that followed, infants, marriage, loss, a badger lies wide open in the poison glen, red felishram spilling out. It is written here among the heather rocks and electric eyes. She was not her father's animal. She was not her husband's prize.
Thank you so much, Emily. Thank you very much, Camilla. And thank you very much, Rachel. It's been a really interesting conversation to listen to today. Thank you for being part of it.
Thank you
very much. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to be here.
Thank you. Could talk all day.
You have been listening to Across Divides. Learn more about today's topic and find opportunities to get involved at icommunityhub.org. iCommunity is a joint initiative of The Wheel and NICFA and is supported by the Northern Ireland Department for Communities, the Department of Foreign Affairs Reconciliation Fund, and the Shared Island Unit in the Department of the Taoiseach.